This message is brought to you by DoNotAge.org, the longevity research organisation that's on a mission to extend health span for as many people as possible via products that actually work. Start your journey today at DoNotAge.org and use code LLAMA for a 10% discount. That's LLAMA.
We might say, well, you need to eat a healthy diet, but okay, that's great, you're talking about that, but how do I, living in this community, actually access that? We as scientists should try to help not only talk about it, but help implement, actually make it something that's a feasible option for people.
Hello and welcome to the LLAMA podcast. I'm Peter Bowes, and LLAMA, Live Long and Master Aging, is where we explore the science and stories behind human longevity. Today I'm at the Davis School of Gerontology at the University of Southern California to meet Dr. Laura Pomato, who is the first person to receive a PhD in the Biology of Aging program at this university. It's the first formal program of its kind in the US. Now, Laura's main interest is oxidative stress, something we hear a lot about in relation to longevity and the question, why does an organism lose its ability to cope with oxidative stress during aging? Laura works with fruit flies. She has undergraduate degrees in human development and aging and biomedical engineering. And away from the lab, she's competed as a member of the university rowing team. Laura, welcome to the LLAMA podcast.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations on the PhD.
Oh, thank you.
And this is quite a unique achievement because, as I say, it is the first course of its kind that you've completed.
Yeah, it is. It's the first, I guess I'm the first PhD or the first person to graduate with a PhD from the new USC Biology of Aging program. And it's a great opportunity because it's been the first one that is really uniting the Buck Institute, which is one of the leading institutes on aging, and also the Davis School of Gerontology, where you also have some of the top researchers in the aging field are all in one building.
The Buck Institute's a great place. We had Eric Verdin, the president, on the podcast a few weeks ago, and there's some remarkable research going on there.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And just having the opportunity, especially as a student, to be able to sort of do transitions or do exploring the labs up at the Buck and then also being able to work down here at USC is really a very unique part of the program and makes it really, I guess, maybe one of the new gems of USC.
And we're essentially in your backyard because you were a local woman. You were born in Orange County.
Yeah, I was born in Orange County, basically area of Tustin. And then I went to USC as an undergrad. I originally was doing biomedical engineering for my undergraduate degree. And then I was sort of flipping through USC at the time. They had a book that was going through all the different programs that each of the schools offered. And the Davis School of Gerontology, I saw it and I was like, what is gerontology? What is aging about?
It's one of those words, actually, a lot of people just have never even heard of it before and actually getting a grasp of what it's all about.
Yeah, right. So when I first saw it, I didn't know what gerontology was. I was like, what is this all about? And so I got really interested in trying to learn more about the program. And so on the USC Learn About USC Day, I came up here with my dad and we actually talked to Jim DeVera, who's still the undergraduate advisor. And so he recommended, you know, just to kind of get your feet wet in gerontology and sort of understand a little bit about it, you should enroll in one of these introduction to gerontology classes. And so I started with that. I loved the class and I picked up an undergraduate degree in gerontology. And then I went onwards and now I just finished my PhD in it. So it's been a wonderful experience.
So it's been quite a journey. Is there something about gerontology, maybe looking at your childhood and your early years, that's particularly interested you? Did you have a sort of a built-in interest to start with? And that was something that you nurtured as a result of this education?
Yeah. When I was a little kid, I actually was really close to my grandparents. And I feel like a lot of people have a similar story. They grow up and they have that very unique kind of bonding relationship with their grandparents. And so when I was a kid, my grandparents were about probably 5 minutes away. And so it really made it, they became a really big part of my life. And so getting to see that from a child's perspective, and then as I've moved on and through my teens, they were a big part of my life. And so watching them actually going through the aging process, and then also once they passed away and sort of seeing some of the areas that were maybe lacking in terms of like healthcare and stuff like that, it really sort of added more of my desire to kind of pursue gerontology.
Your journey towards biology took you through engineering as well.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit different.
Yeah, that was more for my dad. He wanted to make sure that I had an engineering degree. He's an electrical engineer. And so I was like, okay, Dad, well, I'll stick with biomedical engineering. And so it was actually a really nice overlap with gerontology, because you're now taking an aging perspective and bringing that to an engineering on top of an engineering background. And so I feel like the two together actually created a really unique undergraduate program for me, because a lot of engineers don't always look at, well, what happens to us with age and how do we actually solve these problems? Because aging itself is a great engineering question. And so if you can kind of apply that, it would be actually, it's pretty unique.
Yeah. In fact, it's particularly interesting because a lot of people working in the field of gerontology these days prefer to see the human body as a machine and to try to diagnose it in that way and look to the future by applying the principles of engineering as opposed to what we understand as biology.
Yeah, that is a really interesting point, because it's always, how do we fix the system, right? How do we, they look at aging, it's like it's a broken system, and how do we fix it or repair it? And then it kind of, you take that from the gerontology side, it's like, well, is it really broken? Is aging really sort of a disease? I guess as Google is now sort of pushing of aging, we're going to cure aging. And it makes you wonder, well, is it a disease? How do we separate out the two?
That's something we've talked about a lot. Where do you stand on that in terms of defining aging, the umbrella description, as a disease?
So I wouldn't say aging is a disease. I don't think that's, you know, the right connotation, because it makes it sound like there is something wrong. I think aging, it's a natural process. I think it's a natural thing that we're all going through. It's not really a disease.
I think a lot of people try to describe it as the condition that causes the diseases, that things happen to us because of the aging process.
So I would agree with that statement, but I'd also say you can't say aging and chronic diseases are one and the same. And I think that's one of the biggest issues, is people assume, well, chronic disease is a result. It is a result of aging, but aging isn't a result of the chronic disease. They seem to be two different things. And it's so difficult to sort of separate out the two. A lot of the times I feel like when they're trying to develop different drugs or different ways of slowing the aging process, they use markers for chronic diseases, and those are not always the same as markers for aging. And so being able to separate out those two, I think, would be helpful as we move forward in trying to improve the health span, not so much the lifespan.
So perhaps more accurate, as you say, really, to describe chronic diseases being as a result of aging, and that they are seriously much more likely to happen as you hit 50, 60, 70, you're more likely to suffer from those chronic diseases. Mm-hmm. It's almost just a fact of chronological life.
I agree. It is. It seems like they're kind of one and the same of that chronic disease resulting from aging. But how I'm looking at it, or how I think what we should maybe approach it, is that if there's a way of sort of compressing the onset of a chronic disease to a smaller part of the lifespan, and in that way improving the health span, then you end up having a much better quality of life, and then the aging process itself might not be viewed as so detrimental in such a negative light.
It's what I hear time and time again, that is all about extending those years that we are healthy and able to enjoy life without those chronic diseases hitting us. Cancer may still happen, but if we can be 95 instead of 75, it gives us 20 extra years of good life.
Exactly. And I look at it too, we're aging. A lot of the times when I hear people talk about aging, they talk about this chronological aging too. And so when, as a younger person talking about aging, you end up listening to, sort of put on these stereotypes of an older person. But as people age themselves, I don't feel like they don't see themselves as, you know, as a 50-year-old, sort of still thinks of themselves almost as a 20-year-old. So your body might be aging, but mentally or your own desires and ambitions don't match like an older person.
And also it's probably well accepted that our organs age at a different pace, and that you may well have the brain of a 70-year-old but the body of a 60-year-old. You may well have the brain of a 70-year-old and the body of a 90-year-old. I mean, clearly we are all different, but that sense of feeling physically fine, well, let's put it the other way, of not feeling physically fine
of there being something wrong, but mentally you still want to do the things that you could do 30 years ago. That's quite common, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think that's, again, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of just quality of life. You just want to be able to, can you maintain the same activity level that you were able to before? And I think that's one of the, maybe one of the major things, at least when I talk to people as they're aging or like 65-year-olds and above, the goal is really, they still feel like they're young, but physically they might not be matching their mentality of it. And so really the goal is, can you just extend that quality of life?
And is that, if we were to encapsulate your passion for the research and the work that you do now and are going on to do, it is to try to fathom out the science that will help us as human beings achieve what you've just described, that extension of health span?
Hopefully. That's really kind of my underlying desire and motivation behind a lot of what I'm doing right now and what I'm hopefully am able to do in the future is how can we improve the health span and how can we improve the health span disparities between men and women? A lot of the research that I did during my PhD was I uncovered differences between the sexes. So typically women outlive men. And so that's a really interesting question is, well, why is it that women, you know, they have a longer longevity than men do? And so that was sort of an underlying motivation behind a lot of the work that I was doing. And so hopefully it's something I can carry forward.
And there are so many theories about that, aren't there?
Yeah.
In terms of why women do live longer than men, is it hormonal? Is it to do with estrogen? Is it a genetic factor? Are women pre-programmed simply to live longer? I mean, there's so many issues.
There are, yeah. I mean, there's also the mitochondrial difference too, since it's passed down, it's maternally inherited. What I specifically was looking at was stress adaptation, or your ability to cope with stress, or oxidative stress more specifically. And so what that means is that if you give an organism, or what we originally did was actually in yeast, was you give them a small little bit of an oxidant. In this case, we typically use hydrogen peroxide. And it's just enough to sort of stimulate what we call the stress response. And really all the stress response is you can think of it sort of as your cell's soldiers to protect against any kind of damage to the cell. And so when you upregulate these different types of proteins that respond or that remove any kind of damage, you're allowing the cell to cope with that type of stress. And so what we do, or what I was doing, was actually using fruit flies to sort of model this. And so I'd give them actually sort of a stimulant, and then I would give them what we would call a semi-toxic amount of an oxidant. And then we would look at their survival. And so what I found is that females, when they get that little bit of a stimulant, they actually survive longer than females that don't get that stimulant. Now, if you look at males, though, males don't seem to respond at all. And so it really kind of started bringing up, well, what is causing that difference in the adaptive response between males and females? And with age, you actually lose that adaptive response in females. Males don't have it. They just become more sensitive to it, any kind of challenge that you give them. So now the question that I'm trying to figure out is how do you restore that response with age, and then understanding, well, what is it about a female that enables her to adapt that a male isn't able to do that?
And as you say, you use fruit flies for these experiments.
Yeah.
And of course, the use of fruit flies very, very common in this kind of research. And again, we've talked about this before. We had Professor Michael Rose on a few weeks ago. And he was talking in some detail about this as to obviously why he uses fruit flies is to do, you explained to us, it's the lifespan. It's the fact that they are actually very easy to work with and get results quickly.
Yeah, no, they're wonderful to work with. So they typically live between 90 to 100 days. So in the time, especially for a graduate student, that's wonderful because that's about 3 months and you have the whole lifespan of that particular strain of fruit fly that you're working with. Another positive is that you have males and females, and they're really easy to genetically manipulate. So what I mean by that is you can actually create fruit flies that are phenotypically, or they appear as a female fruit fly, but at the chromosomal level, they're actually they're males. And so why would that matter? Well, if we kind of tie back to what I was talking about earlier, that difference between male and female stress adaptation, you can then actually explore, well, if you have these what we call pseudo-females, are they capable of adapting? And so what I found out is that when you pre-treat these pseudo-females, they actually are capable of adapting. And so it starts now opening up a whole new plethora of looking at what is it about, like, is there an individual tissue that enables these pseudo-females to adapt and going forth. But yes, so fruit flies are wonderful. I love working with fruit flies. I wish there was more interest or more understanding about the power that the fruit fly as a model for aging has.
And of course, genetically, and maybe surprisingly, actually quite close to human beings.
They are. I think that it's about 60% similarity between fruit flies and humans. And it's really just the major pathways are conserved. So a lot of the longevity pathways that we're seeing in fruit flies hold over into humans, which again makes it another excellent model for aging research.
Take us through almost a day in the life of when you're researching using fruit flies. What is the process?
If I was to set them up for, say, a lifespan experiment. So typically what you would do is you can say you have a protein of interest that you're looking at. So we normally look at the 20S proteasome. 20S proteasome, all it is, you can think about it as a garbage disposal protein for the cell. So it basically degrades any other damaged proteins in the cell. And so what we can do is we can get a strain of fruit flies that either overexpress, so meaning that they have a higher basal amount of that protein. And then we can mate it to what we call a driver strain. And that's really a way of we can then control when we turn on, meaning when we overexpress our protein of interest or when we don't. And so what we do is we then mate it and we get the progeny that now enables us to either overexpress our gene of interest. And so to do that, I mean, it's pretty simple. It's not very difficult. You basically just collect males of one strain and then females of the other strain, and then you allow them to mate, and then nature takes over, and then you just collect the progeny, and then you're able to do whatever it is your question is with that strain.
What kind of lab conditions do you keep these fruit flies in? What kind of management do they need day to day?
Yeah, so unlike C. elegans or the little nematode worm, which you can freeze down, unfortunately you can't freeze down fruit flies. So we actually have...
And those worms are also a very good model for longevity research.
They're wonderful too. They even have a shorter lifespan than fruit flies. But with fruit flies, we actually have to store every strain. So we have all different types of strains that we can turn on and off different genes. And you have to store them we keep them about 19 degrees Celsius. And so every month, they have to be what we call tossed over into fresh food so we can maintain that stock. So when I say tossed over, meaning we transfer them into the new bottles that have new food for them and let them progeny or let the strain continue.
So, what do they feed on?
They live on cornmeal, sucrose, a little bit of yeast, and some antimicrobial antibacteria. Yeah, they have a very sort of set diet. But that's kind of an interesting aspect too, is you can then manipulate the diet of fruit flies, and you can see in terms of caloric restriction, you can see extensions in lifespan and whatnot. So diet's it's a pretty easy one to manipulate.
And clearly those clinical conditions are vital in terms of controls, et cetera, for the experiments that you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, we like to keep the same food, same as much as possible, same conditions that you have between different strains, different populations and whatnot.
For those of us who are not in a laboratory every day and are not seeing those quick results that hopefully you'll see over a period of weeks, describe maybe your mindset in terms of your enthusiasm for this work. There must be hills and troughs in terms of the process that you go through. There must be quite a lot of expectation, waiting to see results and then devising a new experiment based on the results that you've just seen. Describe that journey to us.
So typically how I approach, I guess, a project when I'm starting a new project is I sort of think of what's the overall question that I'm trying to answer, and then I start breaking that down into smaller chunks. And then I try to figure out, well, what strain of fruit fly, what conditions will help answer one component of this overall question. In terms of hills and troughs, I mean, every graduate student, I feel like you go through that phase of ups and downs. And a PhD in general, I feel like you have, it's a mental marathon of staying positive about what you're doing and really remembering what is it that is motivating you, especially when you're stuck there late at night or if you're coming in on the weekends and whatnot to set up different experiments and all that sort of things. And so for me, my motivation is I just get excited about this. I mean, I've always been really interested and fascinated about, you know, what causes us to age, and is there a way of really restoring that response or restoring our ability to basically yes, chronologically we might be aging, but is there a way to make us look like we're still biologically a young individual? And that to me is just such an interesting question. And so the area that I'm in, I feel like really helps to sort of answer that, or at least put me down a path that I'll hopefully be able to contribute something that can help answer that question. And so that's kind of my motivation when stuff isn't going the way, isn't working out, or isn't maybe going the right direction. And always just keeping a positive mind that even if you get a negative result, that's still useful. And so that it can help shape then your next question and the next direction you go.
What you're saying is that enthusiasm simply helps accept and acknowledge that science can be quite mundane.
Mm-hmm.
At a day-to-day level, it is data, it's setting things up, and it's watching things progress actually quite slowly.
Yeah, no, I agree. It can be a little, sometimes it can be monotonous, but I also think being in the School of Gerontology, it's a really unique environment because we are such a small school that you really get to know a lot of different people and you get to hear about everyone else's research. And so when stuff becomes monotonous, quote unquote, you can go in and sort of talk to other people about, well, how's your research going and what are you doing? And then that can kind of stimulate, oh, well, that's a really interesting point. I wonder how that would tie in with what I'm working on or something like that.
I guess it must help bring some perspective when you can see those human studies and perhaps correlate them with what you're discovering in with fruit flies or mice experiments, rodents, whatever they happen to be. It is ultimately about people.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah. I mean, that's always the ultimate question, right? Like, why is it we would use a little worm or a fruit fly or even a mouse? It's really just to help us understand in a more simple model of what might be going on in a human. And so it always comes back to that of how can we extend the longevity for a human eventually? And how can our work help maybe spur that forward?
And of course, you must, and I'm sure you've heard this many times before, people questioning whether you really can extrapolate what happens in a mouse or a fruit fly with what happens in a human being.
Yeah, that's definitely always a good thing to keep in mind. And I think that's why a lot of the times we try to see, is this possible in multiple models? So can you, a response that you're seeing in a fruit fly, does it hold over in a worm? Does it hold over in a mouse? And then is there a way now to see it? Does it hold over maybe in primary cell work and stuff like that before you even move up into humans? Because humans are so much more tricky.
So coming back to your research on oxidative stress and fruit flies, in terms of where you are at the moment, what would you say is the most optimistic, exciting discovery that you have made yourself?
So probably for me, one of the biggest ones is actually, so we look at two different stress responsive proteins, the 20S proteasome, which is really the cellular garbage disposal of the cell. And then I also look at the mitochondrial lawn protease, and it does a similar job as the 20S proteasome, where it breaks down oxidized proteins in the mitochondria. And so one of the really unique things that I found when I was going through my PhD is that the expression of lawn, the protein expression of it, there are three isoforms that show up in females and only two isoforms that show up in males. And that's
when
really
you say
unique.
Isoform?
Isoform, it meaning like a fragment of the protein.
Okay.
So it makes it very unique. Most stress-responsive proteins you only have, you'll have the same protein expression between males and females. So this is kind of a unique finding. And it's something that I've noticed that translates over. It's conserved in mice. So tissues from mice show a similar pattern. And so we're thinking now that maybe this difference in lawn expression might be contributing to maybe mitochondrial, maybe females are better able to cope with mitochondrial stress than males are. And so that really is what led me to look at developing these what I call pseudo females. So these are, again, fruit flies that are, they appear female, but at the chromosomal level, they're male. And so what happens in these is that they're able to adapt. And so now the new project that I'm working on is actually figuring out, well, what individual tissues in a female enable it to adapt. And so you can now, again, wonderful thing about fruit flies is the genetic manipulation, is you can turn just a single component of a male, you can feminize it. So we can feminize the nervous system of a male, we can feminize the gut of a male, we can feminize the what we call the fat body. So those are just like almost their equivalent to the human liver. And then we can look at the different components of that and see, is one of those components able to enable a male to adapt? if you feminize it. So that's really the project I'm working on right now. And hopefully one of those will pan out and we'll see from there. Because if one of them shows up, then it really helps us to narrow down into a specific tissue and figuring out, well, is there something about, say, the gut that enables the female to adapt and then start looking at maybe into higher organisms like a mouse.
And once you have a full understanding of these processes,
mm-hmm.
what is the next step? Is it some sort of pharmaceutical intervention to help us extend those healthy years?
Yes, that's a great question. And that's really what I'm hoping to pursue when I move on for my postdoc, is figuring out, is there a pharmaceutical, like what you're saying, a pharmaceutical intervention that will sort of mimic this adaptive response? I mean, maybe it also could be looking at it. What I'm really excited about and hopefully can try soon is looking at the impact of caloric restriction and how does that affect the adaptive response? Because that's a really non-pharmacological intervention.
It is, and it's a fascinating area. And, of course, people will talk about pharmaceutical interventions that can mimic caloric restriction mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, because no one wants to...
getting more complicated because people don't want to...
want to do caloric, yeah.
It, go hungry.
Yeah. But, yeah, so that's really the trajectory that I'm hoping to pursue and I'm really excited about.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm curious, in your own life, and maybe it's early days yet, but how do you apply the knowledge that you have gleaned from your studies to how you live your life?
So I think probably the biggest thing for me is I practice moderation. So I don't go...
It's funny you should say that. I've done so many stories over the years, for the BBC mostly, where the final line is... moderation in everything is probably the best advice, whether you're talking about extreme exercise, extreme diet, as mm-hmm. some people say, and that could involve caloric restriction. Moderation seems to come out as the winner at the end
yeah.
of the day.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I try to, you know, limit in terms of the amount of calories I take in and whatnot, but I'm more of... you know, just eat a well-rounded, healthy diet, making sure. The biggest thing that I've found, too, is getting enough sleep. I've been amazed the impact of sleep can have on your longevity and just your long-term health, and then just physical activity, too. And so those are really kind of the things that I sort of take away from it.
Do you have a hierarchy? I think I agree with you on sleep. I'd probably put sleep at number one.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't get enough sleep, you tend to eat too much in the day following, and you know, everything has a knock-on effect.
Yeah, yeah. No, I would agree. I think sleep is just so important, and I feel like it's such an undervalued thing in our society. And there's so many, especially like we have so many undergrads here on campus that I'm like, oh, you guys should be getting as much sleep as possible. But yeah, I'd probably rank sleep as on the top, and then probably exercise and then diet as well.
Do you do well with sleep yourself?
I try to. I try to get at least 8 hours. Doesn't always work, but again, moderation. So
people are always interested in tips in that regard. Do you have any tips for sleeping in terms of lifestyle?
Oh, in terms of lifestyle? I mean, I usually fall... I think I'm very fortunate. I fall asleep really quickly. So I don't know if
you're
it's
lucky.
Just years of deprivation as an
asleep.
Undergrad. Yeah. Well, I think it also exercise really helps with that, too.
And what about you're interested in caloric restriction, the impact of diet in terms of when you eat and how much you eat
yeah.
as it applies to sleep?
Mm-hmm. So what I've been sort of taking up is trying to do the only eating within an 8-hour period.
I've been trying to do that, too.
Yeah.
the 16-8 diet.
Yep. Yeah. And so... I find that works pretty well for me.
How do you work that? Are you a sort of later in the day eating mm-hmm. person? So you maybe have your late meal 6 or 7 in the evening and don't eat till late in the morning or something like that?
Yeah, I usually I do more of like a late breakfast, early lunch kind of thing. And then from there, I don't know. I feel like some people, it works for them or it doesn't work. And I think that's the other interesting aspect is that there's no one set approach that will work for everyone. And I think it's important to be open-minded and try different things. If one thing isn't working, you know, maybe try something else.
And when you say working, what's the definition of working?
Well, so what I mean by working is, I mean, I guess just listen to how your body's telling you, how you're feeling and whatnot. If it's not, you know, if it doesn't feel good, or if you're feeling really lethargic the next day from one approach of when you're eating and whatnot, then just change it up.
Because it is I think as everyone knows, I've experimented with so many of these regimes and continue to do so. But it is a balance, isn't it, between how you feel today and how you think you might feel in 30 years' time.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are lots of invisible effects invisible to us in terms of perhaps IGF-1 that is reduced by fasting, other biometrics that change because you've moderated your diet. You might see no discernible changes day to day, but maybe down the road in terms of prevention of disease, you will. And it's balancing that potential with, as I say, what it's like today.
No, I very much agree. And I think that's a really difficult concept for a lot of people to recognize, because people want, at least when I've been talking to other folks, is that they always want an immediate effect. They want an immediate response. And a lot of the stuff, you're not going to get an immediate effect. It's more of that long-term, long-haul approach. And so especially, I think, for the younger generation, it's very difficult to recognize like how what you're doing now is going to affect you as you get older. And I feel like a lot of people, the parents, older individuals will always say, oh, I wish I had done this, or I wish I had done that.
Or I wish I had known about
exactly
in my 20s and 30s and might have done it.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's one of the biggest things that I try to talk to people that are my own age, is that, you know, you really should try to limit this, or you should try to, you know, really think about long term, how is that going to affect you going forward?
Just going back to the sort of the 16-8 regime, mm-hmm. in terms of what you want to achieve from it, how mm-hmm. do you decide that it's working for you?
For me, it's usually how I feel the next day. How do I feel sort of long term in terms of...
Is it mental agility?
Mental and also physical, in terms of, do I feel really tired? Because I notice depending on what I eat, it'll affect how I feel the next day. So if I eat really late, I usually wake up pretty tired the next morning. And so really figuring out, well, when is the cutoff time of like the last time you should eat for that night? And so for me, it's just really just listening to my own body and figuring out.
And have you tried fasting?
I haven't. I do like to eat. I haven't quite been able to do the 72-hour fast. I know folks next
or even a 36-hour fast.
Yeah,
just one day in a bit.
Yeah, I should. I think the problem is when you're sitting for a while, you just want something to munch on, and so that's it's so hard.
It's a fascinating area to me, because I've tried Volta Longo, mm-hmm. 5-day fast mimicking diet,
yeah.
A periodic fast, and repeated it several months later. And certainly to me, that's something that gets much easier the more you do it.
Yeah.
I've also tried the shorter term fasts of just basically a water diet and maybe a cup of black coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And both are similar. I think you feel the same sensation. Certainly mental agility, I think, after a couple of days of fasting improves.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel, and lots of people recall this, you feel absolutely great. The downside to me is the tiredness and the lack of sort of physical strength,
yeah.
that you feel after a while.
Yeah.
So it's a balancing act.
It is. And I just think that's so important that people recognize that, and then you sort of figure out, well, what works for me, and not trying to fit yourself into, well, this worked for this person, so it must work for me. So I think it's important to just kind of experiment. You can be your own test subject.
It's fascinating. How do you feel? We're here, we're in Los Angeles, we're mm-hmm. surrounded by a city that frankly is largely obese,
mm-hmm.
like most cities in the United States. How do you get that message across to a wider society about diet, health, longevity?
Yeah, and I very much agree. I think it's very important that we as researchers, we should be doing more to communicate with the general population. We should be doing more to share what is it that we're finding with, you know, people that are actually helping to fund this research. And I think that's really important. I think as scientists, we've maybe dropped the ball a little bit on really communicating this with the general public and easy ways for them to implement to help with longevity, because overall it'll help all of us if we're able to lower the presence of different chronic diseases, such as you're saying, obesity. Well, that leads most likely into type 2 diabetes, which then has a whole plethora of other complications that arise with it. And so in terms of helping to sort of spread the word, I think it's something that I would like to do more of. I for one, I know I haven't done enough, and so it's something that is definitely one thing I'd like to do more of in the future.
Which ultimately, I suppose, is the point of the research that you're doing. It is for the greater good in mm-hmm. terms of longevity of populations. And the obvious benefits are that just people are better.
Yeah.
They're living and their lives are happier. and there isn't so much misery because of chronic disease, but there's also a financial, fiscal element to this as well. Think of the money that is spent on trying to treat
all of them,
all of those diseases as they occur.
Yeah, I mean, and again, that's it's something I agree with so wholeheartedly because we just don't do enough. And I think as scientists or basic researchers or basic scientists, we get so wrapped up in our one component of the bigger picture that we sometimes forget to step away and say, how can we help? You know, actually make a direct impact. And so that's something that I think we need to get a little better about and do more.
What do you think needs to be done to improve that? Is there a need perhaps for more communication, education for science students?
I think that would be an excellent way of doing it, is having like PhD students or even just undergraduates. I mean, our undergraduates here do some phenomenal research, and giving them the opportunity to share that with the community, I think would not only be beneficial to the community, but it would be so beneficial for our undergraduate population as well. So it's a win-win on both sides. The other issue, too, is that we can communicate all of this information to the general population, but there are so many other issues that I feel like, especially in the population around USC, that are financially maybe not as well off as most students that go to USC. And so we need to be doing more in terms of promoting exercise, promoting healthy diets, and not just talking about it, but actually doing things that can make it feasible for those communities. Because we might say, well, you need to eat a healthy diet, but okay, that's great, you're talking about that, but how do I, living in this community, actually access that? And there just isn't, I think, the infrastructure. There are so many other hurdles that are going on that we as scientists should try to help not only talk about it, but help implement, actually make it something that's a feasible option for people.
You're right. It is a huge issue. And of course, we are close to, let's say, South Los Angeles, mm-hmm. which is one of the most notorious areas for being difficult to buy healthy food. Yeah. The number of fast food places. Of course, we're getting into politics and urban planning issues here as well.
Yeah.
But it is a much bigger issue.
And I think it's something that we should, irrespective of your politics of it, I think it's something that we all should be paying attention to, because this will have eventually, could have a huge financial impact. Because if people aren't able to have, you know, a healthy lifestyle or a healthy diet or do things to sort of prevent a chronic disease or prevent different long-term diseases that can have huge financial strains, that we're all going to suffer the consequences of that. So I think it's something that we should all sort of maybe be considering and trying to figure out ways of implementing or preventing.
Away from the lab, I'm curious about this. I mentioned it in the introduction. You're a rower.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I had a great opportunity as an undergraduate here at USC, where I was actually a walk-on onto the women's varsity rowing program here.
A walk-on?
A walk-on, yeah. So
what does that mean?
It means I wasn't recruited to actually row. I learned about it they had a activities fair on campus, and I thought, oh, rowing, what is this all about? I'll give it a go. And I loved it. I did it all 4 years through undergrad, and it was such a wonderful experience. It really makes you pretty tough, makes you set you up well for the PhD.
Quite a challenging form of exercise.
It is, yeah. But it was a great group of girls. There were a lot of people from Europe that came over, so you had a really diverse set of teammates. And so I still row now. I actually row out of the Long Beach Rowing Association. And that's a pretty amazing organization, because not only do we have young athletes, but we have athletes of all ages. So rowing is definitely a sport you can do forever. And it's pretty amazing to learn from former Olympians, and they'll come in and they'll help mentor younger rowers and whatnot. It really helps to create an intergenerational partnership through rowing, and so it's a really fun environment.
And there is a great sporting culture at this university.
Yeah. So USC is definitely probably one of the great places to join the athletic program. It was definitely helped make a very unique experience for me as an undergrad.
You're about to move away from Southern California. Yeah. You're heading to Baltimore.
I am, yeah. I was really fortunate. I received an intramural postdoctoral fellowship from the National Institute on Aging. And so I'm really excited. I get to work with...
This has got to be the premier organization that you would want to be associated with.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing opportunity, especially as coming from the School of Gerontology, being able to go to the NIA is something I'm really excited about. And so I have the opportunity to work with Rafa DiCavo, who's one of the leaders in caloric restriction. And so I'm really excited about being under his mentorship and sort of taking what I've developed as a PhD student with me and seeing how I can kind of marry the two different fields.
Now, he did some fascinating research, which you may well be involved with in the future. I don't know, with monkeys and longevity.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting in terms of what they've done with the rhesus monkeys and sort of looking at caloric restriction and how that impacts. Because the monkeys are such a great, that's even closer to humans than mice or even fruit flies are.
And if I remember rightly, the result was that they didn't necessarily live longer, but they lived better in their final years.
Yeah, and so that's just an interesting finding from there. So I'm not sure. Hopefully I'll be able to be involved in that, but we'll see when I get there.
And how will you acclimatize to Baltimore after something
comes upon you? Yeah, lots and lots of sweaters. I feel like layering is a key component.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with that. It sounds like an exciting future, and thank you very much indeed.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity.
And that's it for this episode of the Llama Podcast. Love to hear from you. If you've got any views on this interview or ideas for the future, you can contact us through our website, which is llamapodcast.com. You can get in touch through social media. We're at Llama Podcast, both on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. FlexBeam is a portable red light therapy device that's now being used by leading athletes, including the Norwegian tennis player Casper Ruud.
Whenever you put the FlexBeam on, you feel it starts to work right away. I need something that can help repair all the fibers that I have broken in the serves.
The infrared lights penetrate our skin and makes the muscle tissue recover faster. FlexBeam, I keep it with me all the time.
Recharge Health is offering Llama Podcast listeners an $80 discount on the purchase of a FlexBeam device. Go to the website recharge.health and use the code LLAMA at checkout. That's LLAMA. You'll also find the link in the show notes for this episode.